Welcome to A Lawyer's Guide to the Galaxy, a podcast about geek culture by lawyers with your hosts, Ben Siders and Kirk Taman.
And welcome back to A Lawyer's Guide to the Galaxy, the podcast that asks interesting questions that don't have any answers with your host, Ben Siders. That's me. And the other guy is Kirk Taman.
That's Kirk, guys, and the captain of the Enterprise.
We are intellectual property lawyers and certified geeks practicing law in St. Louis, Missouri. You can find me, Ben, on Twitter at Benjamin Siders. You can find Kirk at KirkDMN. And you can find this podcast at LGG Pod. We're doing it, Kirk. We're recording multiple episodes
in a reasonable
amount of time.
Maybe plurality of episodes to use the patent speak.
Yeah, once this one's done, we'll be done till April, so that's exciting. So today we're going to talk about AI, a topic that we've already recorded one episode on that did not stick for various reasons. So we're going to do it again.
Yep.
And believe it or not, since that last one that we recorded, a lot has changed.
So. Well, that's part of the reason it didn't stick. Things were changing so quickly in this. It was dated by the time we recorded it. But I think that, yeah, we're going to try to talk about a little bit about AI, because obviously it is one of the episodes
that we're talking about. We go to conferences, AI is all anybody wants to talk about or hear about. I just signed up for AIPLA this spring in Austin. If any of you are in Austin, I will be there. Yeah, you can meet me. But yeah, almost all the sessions are about AI and patents, AI and trade secrets, yeah. AI and copyright, AI and what next?
Yeah, and I mean, you hear it in, you know, outside of, you know, intellectual property law, you hear it as, you know, AI in every form of technology. How important is it? It's the most revolutionary, you know, computer thing that's occurred. Okay, yeah, it's everywhere. We should talk about it.
Yes.
And we're obviously going to talk somewhat about the legal issues around it, but, you know, they've already needed some technology here,
too. And it's like any other topic that gets a lot of widestream press. It's already divided people into basically two camps. You have people who think that the singularity is coming sometime in the next 72 hours and we're all going to die or at least be out of work.
Skynet will assume sentence.
And you've got people who think that it's essentially nothing, and they're what I call AI deniers, who think that this is not going to change anything. As usual, I think the truth is probably somewhere in between. And depending on what day of the week it is, what side of the bed I get up on, I'm on either one of those camps. So
I think I tend to fall much more towards the it's really not a thing.
Yeah.
It's a natural progression of what we've seen. And what we just had is my take in conjecture with it is we crossed a line where – in some sense, the general public is seeing it in a way they have not seen it before,
yeah.
Which is making it look like more than it is.
Yeah.
And I'll probably say it repeatedly during the course of this podcast. My whole thing about AI is really, really good at looking like something it isn't.
That's what I always call it, simulated intelligence as opposed to artificial intelligence. Because yeah. I'm not convinced there's any real intelligence in there. But we'll get into that as we go through this. So it's kind of helpful for you just to understand up front kind of how Kirk and I see this. I'm kind of like Kirk. I don't think it's nothing. I think it is an important change that's going to be around. Unlike NFTs, which I think you and I both thought were going to be a flash in the pan thing that would not...
I still
endure.
Think they have very good uses. They're just limited, and nobody's quite found a business case for them yet.
Yeah, well, we said about blockchain, too, right? It's a solution in search of a problem to a large degree. I mean, the problem it solves is not the problem people are trying to use it to solve. But whereas NFTs have kind of disappeared, I think we'll be talking about AI for a while. I don't think we're anywhere near the singularity. I don't think we're even within a decade of full self-driving cars. But I do think that what we've got is going to be disruptive enough that it can't be ignored.
I think it's exceedingly interesting. And I think what we've really got, and we're going to get into this, I think, during the course of this discussion. In my take, what we've seen come out of the AI is we have an area for the first time in law, in life, in everything, where we have created something that we truly don't know how it works.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a first. And that's why I think in some respects it's gotten as much attention it is because since we don't know how it works, we don't really know what it's going to do. And that's why we're paying attention to it. We don't know what it's going to do.
Let's talk about what we mean when we say AI. Before we sat down to record, Kirk and I kind of went through a sort of a catalog of a taxonomy of basic AIs. Because what people are interested in is the ChatGPTs and the image generators and that kind of stuff. But AI is a broad category, and sort of at its most basic, you know, we talked about the example of, I'm going to create a video game to play in AI. Let's do tic-tac-toe, right?
Yeah.
A very easy game everybody can learn without really being able to even read or write all that well. So at the very simplest, I could write a computer AI, and if you've ever taken a computer science class, you may have done this, where that you play against. And a very simple way to code that is the AI is just going to pick a random available square and put its mark there. That's an AI, right?
Yep.
It's making a choice, and it's not exercising human judgment. It's using what, Kirk? Math.
Math.
That's it. It's a random number, right? It's just going to pick a random spot. How hard is it to beat? Probably not very. All you gotta do is get lucky and wait for it to make a dumb mistake and hope it doesn't luck into blocking your moves, but that's an easy AI to beat. Slightly more complicated than that, you can give it some sort of decision making. I might say, if the middle square is open, take it, because that's the best opening move.
Yep.
If it's not, take a corner, and if it's not, take whatever. I might program it to say, if there's a move I can make to prevent the other person from winning, take that move for sure.
Yep.
If not, then take a move that gives me two in a row so I can set up for a win. But all those rules are very simplistic, and once you know how it works, very easy to game it, basically.
Yeah, I think the thing you bump into, and though I'm probably tic-tac-toe, is in many respects, tic-tac-toe is an algorithmic game. Even humans playing it the way
with you with a very small solution space, too.
Yeah, is you do algorithms. I mean, there's a reason why there used to be where you'd play, you know, you can play in Vegas, I think you still can, against tic-tac-toe against the chicken for money,
mm-hmm.
you know, and stuff like that, is because there is such a small decision space, it's relatively easy to train it. Just to give you the idea behind AI, I took a senior seminar in computer science on AI in college in 1996. And we had to do Hump the Wumpus, which is, you know, the old game where you hunt.
We did Connect Four. I had to build a Connect Four engine.
You know, so, and that's the same thing. You're building an engine, you're doing it. AI is not a new thing. It has existed in computer science for a lot of years. It's existed in science fiction for far beyond that. I mean, we had arguably AIs when we were talking about steam power. I mean, they had the idea of artificial robots and everything else. But what we've really got, you know, from it is this concept of saying it is something which is responsive to a human. And one of the big things I think you have to talk about when you talk about AI, we need to mention, is the Turing test. And I think it was early on recognized that the idea behind AI and what you were trying to do is, could you make it that a human couldn't tell that it was an AI? We talk about the idea of like playing tic-tac-toe.
Yeah.
You can probably tell that it's an AI because you see the randomness. You see the algorithmic nature of it. Now, in that, because it's so simple, a human being is going to play the same way, so it may not be that easy to tell the difference. But for a long time, that was the gold standard. It's basically, could a human detect that it wasn't a human they were working against?
Which historically has been pretty easy, because the AIs have been not very human-like.
Yeah, and they've existed in games forever. I mean, video games have always had AIs. I mean, there's always a way to play against the computer. That's an AI.
If you think about it, in some sense, the real breakthrough with the LLMs, the large language models, the ChatGPTs, is the fact that it understands on some level natural language human inputs, and it produces on some level natural language human outputs. If you think about the history of how mankind has understood intelligence, if it can communicate in language, it seems smart. And if it can't, it doesn't, right? So although animals communicate, they don't speak the way we do, and they don't seem to understand our speech the
way
we do.
We're starting to question that.
So we think that they're dumb, right? And even human beings who have language impairments have historically been categorized as having some kind of cognition impairment, whether or not they actually do. So it's sort of a psychological bias amongst humans that we understand things that look and talk and speak and sound like us, and don't understand us, to be smart.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, there's been, again, one of the things we have to sort of, I think, constantly bring into this is that a lot of these issues are explored in science fiction. They really are.
Yeah.
AI is something that's been explored, you know, behind it, you know, with concepts like, you know, something saying, I speak, you know, and that's not necessarily an indication that you are intelligent. And that's said in one of the Star Wars movies.
Episode one.
You know, yeah, episode one.
I think Qui-Gon says it to Jar Jar.
Exactly.
And he was right.
And so, you know, that kind of thing is, you know, what you bump into, the sort of preference towards speech being a recognition of intelligence. Beyond the algorithm, what you then have, I think in artificial, as we start talking about AIs, again, I kind of like using the abbreviation AI, so we're not actually saying artificial intelligence, it's just AI. You get into the idea of essentially machine learning, which really is some sense, some concept of feedback.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea is it's not just an algorithm. It's an algorithm that takes into account the action that is given back to it. So when you sort of, you know, to Ben's comment with, it's the, hey, it looks for two. It knows that if there's two in a row to take the blocking position. In some sense, that's machine learning. Because it's doing something beyond it. Now, that's not really, because it's truly algorithmic.
Yeah, that's an example of me telling the machine how to make a decision. With machine learning, we train the machine on how to make decisions and then turn it loose to make them.
And so now we're starting to get into things even like, in some respects, like chess playing, you know, machines and stuff.
Well, we
like
talked
that.
Before this about the example of training an AI, because a lot of AIs, this is another thing that's different, a lot of AIs have been single-purpose AIs.
Yeah.
I want to train an AI to tell facial recognition. Where is the face in this image? Where's the eyes? Where's the nose? We do that by giving it images that have already been tagged with where that data is in the image. So the AI knows when it looks at the data, here's where the eyes are. Here's what the data for that looks like. We don't really care what that data looks like. We just want the AI to look at a million images of faces and look at where the eyes are and see the data similarities in the image data for what is and is not an eye.
Yeah, and what is not a face, because that's what ultimately you're trying to do, is you're trying to get it to identify what is a human face versus what is a dog versus what is something else. And a lot of times that's what these things were being used for, is they were just simply to identify something. So examples you can say is like computer vision. Hey, you know, is this something that I see, a human being, or is it not a human being?
Or the captchas we all fill out. You ever wonder who's responsible for those and why they always want us to identify traffic objects?
Yeah, it's because it's Google, and it's because they're training AIs. Yeah, that's the answer.
Perhaps self-driving vehicles?
That's, I think the biggest thing you really sort of get into is we had all that behind it. Where we really started, I think, getting into the concept in some sense of what we call modern AI is neural networks, which basically was the idea of saying we want to try to simulate the way that you think the human brain operates. Whether or not the neural network is an accurate portrayal of how the human brain operates, I think, is a matter for debate.
Because we don't fully understand exactly how the human brain operates. Reasons either.
But, you know, I think you can look at it and say, we had the idea that a brain potentially could operate this way. Whether or not it's really human, we don't necessarily know. Digitally, it makes sense. We can sort of implement it in something digitally and say this is a neural network. The real key behind a sort of neural network is that we allow it to make connections and we allow it to alter its own programming by what it learns. That's kind of its uniqueness. It's no longer an algorithm that's simply filling in variables. It's now altering the algorithm.
And we've had this for decades. It's been around. Yeah, so what changed 2 years ago when ChatGPT came out and everybody lost their minds?
And I think that's the thing is it's, you know, ChatGPT is, as we know, 3.0, I think, was the one that sort of caused everybody to lose its minds. 2.0 obviously existed before that and did not do that. A lot of it, what it was, is just simply what is it using for training? And that's what I think we now need to get into from this,
also,
is what is training?
It's a generalizable model. Like, yes. it's not trained to detect traffic lights and know when to brake a car or things like that. It will just take free-form language of any kind in an inquiry, in an unstructured English, understand what it means, which by itself is pretty impressive, that it largely gets right what you want it to do. And then it produces output in properly grammatically correct English, and for the most part, usually does what you ask.
Yeah. Although I think it's important to note that, you know, like a ChatGPT, while we say it's more generalized, is also still very specific. It cannot generate an image. It cannot drive a car. All it can do is give language.
In fact, if you ask it to do those things, it will complain and say, well, I can't. I'm not plugged into your car. I'm not plugged into the internet. I can't do anything.
So you bump into that. You obviously can use those same kind of models to have it generate images. Yeah, that's Dolly. You know, there's lots of these things out there we can use it for. But what we're really looking at is we're saying, hey, we've lost the algorithm component now. We have this network. We have this system. And I'm going to start calling it a black box. That does what we give it an input and it spews an output that seems reasonable based upon the inputs and that might be believable for what a human output is. But ultimately, they're all limited by what kind of input they can take and what kind of output they can generate. We don't have something, you know, we have ChatGPT cannot drive a car. Now, part of the reason is because it simply lacks the, you know, the interface with the car. But it also has never been trained to do so. Yeah. If we were to put it into a vehicle and give it full control of the vehicle, it would do nothing. It would just simply talk to you.
Because it's a language model. It doesn't have any image recognition capabilities. It could probably tell you how to drive a car.
Yeah.
It could teach you. It could tell you what to look for. It could give you good driving strategies.
And that's because it literally hasn't been trained on it. It has no idea what to do in conjunction with it, and it lacks the ability to interface with what it's doing. So when we say they're not limited, they are still limited. But they're not limited in the fact that they can spew out a result in conjunction with anything. And I think that's what we really sort of encounter with this, particularly when we talk about language. I think it falls back on the comment that you made earlier, and I think we looked at, is we tend to think the ability to speak is unique.
Yeah. Let's talk, too, about how this intersects with the law, because it does in ways that are both novel and in ways that are not. And this kind of goes back to our original point. People fall into two camps. Some people think this is going to change everything, and some people think this is just the newest version of legal problems we've been solving for centuries.
Yeah.
And again, I think the truth is somewhere in between. I think we do have a lot of existing legal frameworks that can deal with a lot of the issues, but it does present at least whether or not it's categorically different issues, it's certainly qualitatively different. It's not at all to me clear that the legal frameworks we have can just be grafted on top of what AIs do, which I find fascinating on a couple levels. One is that when I talk to AI enthusiasts online, a lot of them seem to think the law is perfectly clear here, and that it's just a matter of time before a court comes down and tells us, yes, that's what it is. And while that may be what happens, I don't think it's because the law is that clear. It just may be that they guess right which way the courts go with this. But we really have really three different issues to deal with, two of which have gotten the most attention. One is, how do we deal with the way AIs are trained and the training data that they use to analyze and develop these statistical models?
And this is particularly unique in the new situations because you need exceedingly large amount of data.
Yeah.
Basically, you need the internet. You're not doing something where it's, yes, I'm training it to recognize, you know, medical images, or I'm using the images provided to me by the hospital and they own them all.
Yeah, if you think about it, so I used to work for a medical imaging company and we did this kind of thing where you would get access to these images. Well, I mean, it's easy to get permission to use them all. I mean, the patients all sign something in the file, or the images belong to the hospital, the medical company, or the radiology company. And you just say, I need a library that's got 150,000 images of a kidney tumor.
Yeah.
Okay, well, here they are. And there you go. And there's very, I mean, just one person to deal with, one license to get, and there's really no other way to do it, right? I can't go on the internet and get that much of that kind of data.
Yeah, you know? It's not on the internet.
It's not on the internet. It's just not there. So, but with a large language model like this that's generalizable, what do you train it on? I mean, you can train it on you know, you could buy books, I guess, and scan them in and train it on that.
But that in itself is potentially
very time consuming.
It's also problematic from a liability point of view.
Or you can go online and scrape data off the internet. There's a lot of ways you can do it. Newspaper articles, tons of stuff you can do. I don't know for sure how all these things have been trained, but we do know what people have accused them of doing. But we should probably stop there, right? Because there's been a lot of lawsuits filed, some of which I think are probably based on unreasonable facts, but they say things with certainty that I don't think follow. And the one I think of the most is the Sarah Silverman lawsuit, where she accused one of them, I think it may have been OpenAI, ChatGPT. She said, they must have scanned and copied my book without my permission, because if I ask it to summarize what's in my book, it can do it. So it's clearly seen it.
Yeah.
Okay, well, Kirk, have you ever read A Christmas Carol?
Yes, I have read A Christmas Carol. I can't say I've read A Christmas Carol. I can say that I definitely know Christmas Carol.
All right.
And I'd say I've read at least a portion of it.
All right. Well, that's a bad example then. How about, have you ever read Henry V?
Good Lord, no.
Okay. So, but you know what I mean? I mean, when's the last time you read Macbeth, right? I can give you works that you've never read, and you can probably tell me what they're about and what's in them in the general plot outline.
Exactly.
I've never seen the movie Deliverance, but I know what happens. I can recognize songs from it. I know who's in it. I even recognize scenes in it, having never seen the film before. And so that's all just to say that some things are so much in the zeitgeist that you don't have to have directly experienced it to summarize it. So, in the Silverman lawsuit where she says they had to have copied it, well, not necessarily. They may have just gotten a copy of the Cliff Notes version or some school website summarizing what was in it or something like that. So there are some leaps of logic being made that don't necessarily follow.
The example being, could you actually provide a pretty good summary of what happened in a book from simply reading the Cliff Notes? The answer is almost certainly.
Yeah.
Even though you've never read the book. So you don't.
I majored in English and wrote A quality papers about books I never read. So I'm telling you, it can be done.
and exactly that. I think that's the sort of thing you bump into. You know, can I tell you that, you know, let's pick any random work of Shakespeare is written in iambic pentameter. I'm pretty sure I can safely say that's true.
Yeah.
Can I then write something in iambic pentameter to about the same plot line as that if I can figure out the plot line? Of course I could.
Let's think about Jeopardy. You know, Jeopardy is kind of like this, where you're asked to make inferential leaps. They'll put out a clue, and you may have actually no knowledge of what they're talking about. But like, there was one the other day where they quoted a line of Shakespeare. It was a play I'd never read, but based on the line, I could tell what play it was in.
Yeah. I think that's the thing for it, is it's, we got to be careful saying an inferential leap there, but I think the idea behind it is it's, there's enough of a trigger. There's enough information.
There's enough context information to draw a reasonable conclusion.
There's enough information in the question, you know, what the answer is. Maybe the best way to put it. Because then, in some sense, the question gives away the answer.
And why don't we go about this? So what's the big deal? I mean, if I'm just scraping public content off the internet, I mean, I can just go to the internet and look at it for free anyway, right? As it's just an internet browser. So this is always where people get a disconnect. If anybody can just go look at these websites, how has it become a copyright violation to scrape them and train an AI?
And the answer is because you're copying them.
Yeah.
When you're on the internet, now admittedly, the internet is also copying them to your computer.
Yeah.
But Congress has specifically said that's okay.
Not to mention, when I put a website out there for you to browse, I have at least implicitly agreed that you can download the website to browse it. Otherwise, why did I do that?
But when I do put it out as a website, I didn't necessarily say that you could print it out. You could, you know, give it to all your friends, or you
adapt,
could make
it,
copies
modify
of
it,
rebroadcast
make
it. Copies of it and say it's your webpage. You know, those are the things I haven't said you could do. And the way we bump into the problem is that a training data, in some sense, is one of those things that I haven't necessarily implicitly said you can do. Now, did I implicitly say you could potentially? Maybe. And I think that's where you kind of get into these kind of arguments, and this is where some of this lawsuit bumps into. If the book is on the internet and you have the ability to access the book, you know, as a human being, does the training data then have access to, you know, does the AI then have an ability to access the book as training data because a human being told it to go look at it? You kind of bump into that thing of are those different or not?
Well, think about photography too. So if you're a photographer and you've got a website out there just showing off your portfolio,
right?
You say you're an architectural photographer. You get hired by architectural firms and building kind of general contractors to go take pictures of these sites. You know, you're going to have a portfolio of the photographs you take, and anybody can go to your website and scrape them. But when you put that stuff out there, did you put it out there with the intention that somebody would then take them all, use it to feed an AI, and then use it to produce architectural photos so they wouldn't have to pay you to do it?
Yeah.
Probably not, right? That's not what you had in mind.
And that's the real problem that we're bumping into, is we're bumping into the fact here that the AI, in some sense, is being trained to replace you. This is the classic training your replacement. The reason why I wanted to look at those architectural photographs you took is so that I can train it how to take architectural photographs. Now, again, can I use your webpage and have my young intern that I want to teach the architectural photographs go look at them? Of course I could. The problem with it is what I'm teaching that person to do is to go take photographs on their own. I'm not teaching the AI. An AI doesn't go out and take photographs on its own. It generates images. Mm-hmm. And it generates images, arguably, from the images that it takes in.
In some sense, at least, right?
In some sense, and that's where we get into the issue of we don't know exactly what's happening inside the black box.
But then you get the argument, okay, so the AI, let's set photographs aside. Let's say it's art. I'm going to scan in a bunch of artwork, Picasso, Da Vinci. I mean, pick the classics or pick Jackson Pollock, doesn't matter. Going to scan a bunch of that in, and then the AI is going to do what the AI does. It's going to look at the underlying data, which is basically a computer understandable representation of the visual elements that we perceive as human beings. And it's going to learn from that. If I say this is a Pollock, it's going to know what the data looks like in a Pollock. And when I say generate a new one that looks like a Pollock, it's going to use similar types of data structures to generate these images, right? Simple enough. So then the argument is, how is that different from how human artists learn? And why does it become a problem just because the computer's done it?
I think one of the problems you bump into with it, just use the thing of it, is if I can go and I can take all of, you know, Pollock's work, and I generate something in the form of a Pollock, it can do it. I can also tell you generate something in the form of a Pollock, and you can do it.
Well, I can.
You probably still could if you actually looked at them. I mean, you can generate something that would look like something he potentially generated because you know what it would look like in judgment. However, did you generate a Pollock? No, of course you didn't, because you're not him. You know, that type of thing. And very likely, whatever you generated is not something he actually ever would have generated because he wouldn't have thought about it the same way you did. By putting, you know, Ben Siders in the way of this thing, what you generate is a Ben Siders in the style of a Pollock.
By adding me, you've ruined everything.
Yeah, you've ruined everything because the fact you didn't actually create a real Pollock. The problem with the AI is we lack the person being put in there. It's taking Pollocks and making a Pollock. And it's not doing anything in that style. And when we say make it in the style of that, it's not using that style. It's effectively using Pollock as a Pollock.
Yeah.
It's just meshing them all.
Yeah, and then and Julia, there's two sides of this, right? There's that the people who are in creative now, their work is being used with, for the most part, no compensation to them directly, although I think that's changing, and we're seeing the engines try to license these things. But, you know, there is no license regime for the internet.
Yeah.
There's nobody to go to get all that. And then on the output side, we have, so far in the United States at least, copyright law has held that the machine is incapable of generating copyrightable works. Or said differently, if it is machine generated, it is not copyrightable not because copyright's inherently incapable of being applied to a machine, but because the way the Copyright Act in the U.S. is written, it assumes a human author. And we know this from the Naruto monkey case, the monkey selfie case. Well, the Ninth Circuit held that, and that's been the last word on it. And they said an animal's not a person. And so if you're not a person, you can't get a copyright.
Basically, even though the human set it up but the monkey did it, the idea was the human lacked the control at the beginning to basically say that they really generated the photo. They didn't. The monkey generated the photo.
Yeah, the monkey chose what to frame in the shot himself and when to push the shutter. The human did not. So now we get into this sort of extended question of, okay, so to what extent is the AI a tool for human creativity and ingenuity versus the author of that? Yeah. And if you've ever kind of said
it's not the author. I think that's an important thing to keep in mind, is it's legally we've said it's not the author, but we still need to look at it sort of philosophically, is it authoring something?
Well, I think I'd say under the Copyright Act, the human's not the author. There is no author, which is why it's, you know, AI generated works are considered public domain and are not copyrightable for the moment. But, Kirk and I are both involved with various IP organizations. I'm involved with a couple of AI committees that kind of keep track of these things. And we kick this around a lot. You know, you have this tension with copyright where we have this idea expression dichotomy, right? The idea behind a work is not copyrightable. The particular expression is. So if I go to the AI and I describe what I want it to produce, I'm giving it the idea, right? And it's giving me the expression, so it's not copyrightable. But Kirk and I have talked about this before. Could I describe what I want with enough specificity that I do acquire human authorship over the output to where there is some copyright?
I basically gave it the expression, and I think the idea, or at least enough of the expression generated. And I think it, as we've kind of come to, that is possible. I'm not sure it's currently possible.
I'm not sure it's happening yet, right? And there is some legal precedent for this. We've seen this with stories. The Wind Done Gone is a good example of that. It's Gone with the Wind. It's the same characters. It's completely rewritten from scratch. I don't think even any of the dialogue is the same. So completely rewritten from scratch, but same characters, same plot, same story. You know, that would be a copyright infringement, even though she didn't copy any literal elements from the story.
Yeah, but it's also separately copyrightable.
Also separately copyrightable, so it's a derivative work, right? Yeah. So we know that you can infringe a copyright by stealing, or not stealing, but just using the non-literal elements. And likewise, you can get a copyright in the non-literal elements. We have this with music. Music is mostly an assembly of non-copyrightable elements. I can't copyright a tempo. I can't copyright a chord progression, a key sequence. I can't even probably copyright a couple of notes.
No sounds, no sound waves for a note. You know?
Yeah, exactly. What is a music copyright? It's those things in combination. This is a thing, and it's really not at all clear at what point you've gone from non-copyrightable AI-generated expression to enough human input and control into it to where you acquire ownership. But then of what?
Yeah. And that's, I think, where we really get into the thing with this is that right now we are exploring an edge case that doesn't really exist, because the problem with it is we need enough human control in some sense to say the output is definitive.
Yeah.
From it, could we hit that point? I think we're all in agreement. Yes. But then if we say, what is it? Well, then what is the output that's definitive? And what is the piece that I told it versus what we have from it? And the best way I think to sort of look at this is it's, if I go in and I say, hey, I'm going to paint something digitally, I'm going to make a drawing using a computer, there's an algorithm picking where the airbrush dots appear to make it look like an airbrush.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't necessarily tell it where I wanted those specific dots to appear, but I gave it enough control that they ended up where I wanted them.
But it's the same thing if I do aerosol art. You know, I don't really have any direct control over exactly where every droplet goes.
Yep.
But I have enough control.
And in the end, I get the artwork that I have. Now, could somebody generate, using another piece of aerosol, another aerosol can, a similar artwork which is sufficiently different to qualify for copyright? Yes. Could it be a derivative work based upon viewing mine? Yes. We kind of look at that. Where we're really bumping into the problem, and where I think the problem in so many respects lies in the AI, is we don't know where the output's coming from.
Well, it kind of is raising the fundamental question, what exactly is artistic creation?
Yeah.
So think about it this way. I can't paint, right? Mm-hmm. So I want to go to the AI and I want to have it create a painting in a particular style, but I want to tell it what's in it. Okay. I want to have a painting to use for my masthead on my Twitter account. So I can go and tell it the elements I want based on some collection, some eclectic group of things that I think would be fun to have together that's unique and creative. So, I can't produce that myself, but the AI can do it for me. Is the artistry in that the idea I had behind what that should look like? And I may go through 100 or 200 iterations before it looks the way that I want. Am I not producing art because I don't have the manual skill? I haven't developed and practiced how to use the brush or how to use Photoshop to produce that.
Yeah, the manual reproduction.
Yeah, so what is the art? Is it the artistic vision which anybody can have to varying degrees, or is it the artistic skill?
And I think what we previously bumped into is we basically said there is an element of artistic skill required in order to be able to say something is copyrightable, is a new work.
Yeah.
You know, I think we can all paint something in our head we can't recreate. We have no ability to do it. When we also look at something like, if we take, you know, the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel, there are elements of that which were pure mechanical reproduction that other people just simply can't do because they lacked Michelangelo's mechanical skill. You know, can a computer do it? Yes, but it can't really paint it unless it paints it, you know, one pixel at a time. And even there, it can't really do it. It almost has to paint it one molecule at a time, which we lack the technology to do. So we kind of look at it and say, there is an element of that physical reproduction which required a mechanical skill, namely the ability to hold a paintbrush and apply paint to a surface, which is what gives part of the ability its actual, you know, expression dichotomy. So we needed the idea, we needed the concept. We also needed the actual mechanical skill to reproduce that concept. And somehow that interaction is what creates the expression.
Yep.
Where I think one of the things we bump into with a computer is it not just a pure reproduction? You know, because we really don't have that sort of that thing unless we have a person somehow controlling it really directly that gives it the mechanical skill.
Yep.
That isn't just pure reproduction.
So this makes me think about Warhol too and the Prince case. You know, it was found to not be a fair use. But if you think about like what Warhol did, is it more artistic vision than mechanical skill? Like, as a Warhol, I mean, how hard is it to produce a silkscreen print?
Yeah, I mean, I think you bump into the issue again with his thing. I think that's some of what we saw in the Warhol case and seen with Warhol generally. Of there's an artistic vision there of what he wants to produce that we can look at and say, okay, this produces that artistic vision. It shows what it's supposed to, things like that. There's a selection mechanically of what it is. Once we know exactly what those things are, could we mechanically reproduce it? Yeah. I would presume I could start with the same Prince photograph, I can get a hold of a silk screener and I can probably reproduce very, very closely exactly what was produced as the end drawing, yeah. You know, the end print of Prince.
But did you have the artistic vision to do what he did?
Or right? What I'm doing is I'm copying him, right? Yeah. You know, that's the sort of thing. But again, to me, reproduce it would also take a lot of mechanical skill. So when we bump into the idea of me saying, hey, can I physically reproduce it? I have to develop the mechanical skill to even reproduce it. So when we now say, no, I'm generating something unique that has it, that I'm not reproducing, I'm doing this to what it is, we've still got that element of mechanical skill popping in as being necessary for the actual expression.
And all these things raise a lot of really peculiar legal issues. And I was recently involved in a committee that submitted comments to the Copyright Office on this. The government wants to know, what should we do? Do we need to do anything at this point? There's always weird questions being raised. And one of the more interesting ones that they said is, you know, do we think current law provides protection for something like a style? Should, setting aside all the copyright issues, should I be able to go to an AI and say, give me a picture of Walt Whitman in the style of a Warhol and have it do it for me? Let's assume that there's no copyright issues. I got a public domain etching of Walt Whitman. I just say, do it in the style of Warhol. Should Warhol's estate be able to say, no, you can't do that? He owns that style.
And right now, I think the law says no.
Yeah, I think very clearly, no.
There's no question that it says no. And I think the real question of what we bump into is, why is it you can copy your style? You know, that's in some sense saying like, you know, wait, does that mean I can't make something in the style of a Renaissance artist because they all had the same style? You know, isn't the purpose of Da Vinci's, you know, workshop to teach his style to other people? Which we would acknowledge, and I'm picking on Da Vinci on purpose because his works aren't under copyright anymore.
Never were.
You know, if I'm training people to use my style in my workshop, does that mean that, you know, they don't own their works that they can generate? I do because it's my style. That's what I'm teaching them to do. You know, or any other school teaching style. Where do we have the line that says it's my style versus it's your interpretation of my style or my follow up to your style? And the real problem I think we bump into with the idea of saying we should have a protection of style is, what's its scope?
Well, yeah, and then who determines whether you've infringed it or not? Because
exactly.
This was the thing in Warhol where they said, we want to set up the law so that we don't have judges and juries trying to sit in the role of art critic and figure out, is this art or not? We want to figure out, did they copy impermissibly or not? That's something that a jury could figure out or a judge could figure out.
Yeah.
But making an artistic judgment, I mean, is this what the law is supposed to do, is have people sitting around listening to experts opine over art styles? I mean, yeah. I don't like that idea. And you know, maybe we don't care so much with art because a lot of us aren't art connoisseurs. But you can imagine other things where you would worry about that. And we're seeing this happen with music, as a lot of these older artists are dying, artists who were famous in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. Their libraries or catalogs are going to heirs or trust administrators who are looking for opportunities to monetize. And because, this is a whole separate topic, but because the scope of what music is being made now is becoming narrower and simplified, everything does kind of sound the same, right? And kind of going back to the mechanics, you know, Ed Sheeran plays guitar and he's pretty, you know, pretty good at it, good songwriter. But, you know, the scope of what Ed can sell is a lot narrower than the scope of what Ed can produce. And so we also have a lot of kids with laptops who can, without knowing how to play any instruments, just use samples and make, you know, really good music that's commercializable and sellable. And so we're seeing all these music lawsuits pop up where everything sounds like everything else and everybody stole everything from everything else. And it's getting to be a little insane. And I'm a little worried about what happens. I mean, there are a couple out there, but what happens when the AI start getting into the music business and producing, make something that sounds like the Beatles, make something that sounds like Nirvana?
Yeah. And I think the real, what we're really sort of having with it, and I'll just start sort of from the, I think the bigger issue. I think we have a problem in copyright law right now that in many respects, copyright is already too big. And what we're bumping into in conjunction with AI is copyright's probably the likely area that AI should be into. But for it to get into this area, we almost need to make it bigger. And that's concerning because we kind of look at it and say it's already too big.
Yeah.
So how do we deal with that type of a problem? And again, that's that thing with style where we look at it and say, you know, and part of the reason I was using Pollock earlier, and the idea I think is a good example. Pollock's mechanical reproduction, I don't think, is nearly as difficult as, for example, Michelangelo's would be. You can much, you know, there's a level of mechanical reproduction of Pollock that essentially any person can do. In many sense, what makes a Pollock is sort of artistic vision.
Mm-hmm.
And the, you know, it's not the mechanical reproduction of how to put the paint on the canvas. It's where to put the paint on the canvas, so to speak. You know, to give it, what we bump into with an AI is an AI should be able to very, very easily reproduce his mechanical reproduction because it's a simpler mechanical thing. If we say that's his style, well, then how much, because it's simpler style, how much more does he get versus what's a Michelangelo style? There's fewer people that could produce a Michelangelo that could produce a Pollock, you know, something that looks like it. And again, I'm not saying actually reproduce the exact things, something that would look like it or something that a non-art critic, the average person on the street, would actually be able to tell the difference between. And I think that's the hardest part you bump into is, do we want copyright? Do we want IP getting into this area? Because we've always kind of said no.
And I, as of right now, that seems to be where it's heading. Like, the major proposals on the table are, okay, if we think AIs are good and we want to encourage them to be created, then do we just need to say that using the training data, whether you have permission or not, is a fair use? Mm-hmm. So when we start there, like, is it even a copyright infringement? So I think the answer is pretty clearly that. It should be. You're making a copy of something. Yeah. Maybe you have permission to make that copy, like from the web, for example. I'm going to go to a website and download a copy of the web page so I can view it on my computer. That I can probably do. But once I take it and feed it to the AI to do the analysis, there's sort of an open question. Is the resulting data that it extracts from that? Because I can get the image. Let's say I'm going to do celebrity photos. I get all the celebrity photos I can find. I scrape them off IMDb. I feed them to my AI to train it to recognize faces. And then I can throw all the photos away. I don't need them anymore. The AI has been trained. And the data it has, I don't think we know for sure, but we pretty strongly believe it doesn't actually have any of that raw data anymore. It has data about the data that it found, and maybe even data about that data to identify these patterns. But I could never go in and say, give me that photo back out. It no longer has that data. It can't produce it.
Yeah, it can't reproduce any photo we fed it completely accurate. Yeah. I think that's the way to put it.
I've made a copy. Arguably, I had permission to make the copy I made. Arguably not, to the extent that the copy I give to it is an additional copy. But then is the resulting database a derivative work? And that I don't think is as clear as a lot of people think it is.
This is where I think you really, this is the hard part around this.
Yeah.
Because where we look at it previously behind it, there's a distinction that's been made around a lot of the copyright of transitive copies, which is a lot of how you deal with the internet and things. Yes, a copy was made, but it's a transitive copy. It just passes through something so that the end product can be produced. That's kind of what we have here. We kind of have a transitive copy. It's the same way the image on your webpage passes through a server to get to you.
Yeah.
The fact that the server has a copy, it doesn't really matter. It's transitive. It passes through. That's kind of what this is. It takes the image. Yes, there's a transitive copy that gets fed to the AI, but it doesn't stay there. It doesn't even get spit back out. It just literally goes away.
So here's the definition of derivative work. And just to be clear, if you're making a derivative work of somebody else's thing without permission, that's copyright infringement.
Yeah, it's copyright infringement.
It's the most common one we deal with when we want to use other people's stuff. So here's the simplest part of the, this is part of the definition. A derivative work is a work based on one or more pre-existing works. Okay. Well, it sure seems to be based on, but then it says this, such as a translation, musical arrangement, dramatization, fictionalization, motion picture version, sound recording, art reproduction, abridgment, condensation, or any other form in which a work may be recast, transformed, or adapted.
And I think what we really got to get into there is we have this laundry list of things,
yeah,
which all basically say take the same work and just make it.
Change it.
Change it, but don't change it into the new work.
But have we done that though? If you think I got this image data.
Yeah.
But it's not the image; it's the data. It's the bits and bytes and the ones and the zeros. It's not the colors on the screen.
Exactly. And I don't have a work in some sense that's internal to the machine. I don't even have a work. Arguably, I have.
That's the question, right? Because data by itself is not protectable. Generally, yeah. Collections of data are if there's creativity in the selection and arrangement of the data. But is there originality and creativity in the selection and arrangement of the extracted data?
It can't be because that's not entirely human was involved, right?
Yeah, the AI did it, so it's not even clear that would count. And then another example, a work consisting of editorial reviews, revisions, annotations, elaborations, other modifications, which as a whole represent an original work of authorship, is a derivative work. That doesn't really help us much. So
I think it's those three words, though, that popped up right after we had sort of the laundry list of things. We said it's transformed.
Recast, transformed, or adapted.
Yep, recast, transforms, or adapts. In some sense, that's what's become derivative work. Did you recast it? Did you transform it? Did you adapt it?
So if the AI's sort of internal data model is not a derivative work, then the question is, once a person comes along and says, okay, give me a Pollock, what it produces, is that a derivative work of the inputs that it got?
Yeah.
Now, I think there's a much stronger argument there that in some sense it almost has to be. Otherwise, why do we need the trading data in the first place?
Yeah. And since I told it it's a Pollock, it obviously knows what a Pollock is. So it's presumably copying Pollock. It's not getting what is a Pollock from what is a Da Vinci. You know, yeah. I mean, that kind of thing sort of with it. If I tell it to copy someone's style, it knows what the style is based upon what the data was. So even if it doesn't have Pollocks stored in its database, it somehow knows what a Pollock is.
Yeah.
Just kind of, and now we're starting to get into some sense the sort of weird, you know, like philosophical questions about what is an AI know?
Yeah. Well, and then on a higher level than that, what does it mean to pay homage versus rip off or a copy? So let's look at music. You and I have both been to the National Museum of African American Music History in Nashville. Yeah. And there is a really fun display there where you can start with, Jelly Roll. And you can go all the way to David Bowie, right?
Yeah.
You can go through and see where famous jazz, blues, ragtime artists got their start and their inspirations, who inspired them, who were their contemporaries, and who did they later inspire. And you can go all the way through from the earliest wandering artists in the South in New Orleans all the way up to, like I said, a British singer like David Bowie. Those influences are all there. So, but, you know, again, this is how people learn to do things, right? I listen to music I like. I like the Beatles, and I like 70s rock. I like Zeppelin, I like Van Halen, Eagles, that kind of stuff. Yeah. And I like the 90s stuff. So when I sit down and write music, guess what it sounds like? It sounds like Alice in Chains. You know, it sounds like the Rolling Stones, or some mix of those, right? That's how all these artists work.
Yeah.
So you know, in a sense, humans are doing the same thing, right? I'm taking all these inputs and studying and examining them, and then from my own imagination, producing something new that is definitely derivative in some sense from them, but it's not recasting or transforming or adapting them. So is it, does it become infringement when the AI does it?
Yeah, and that's, again, I think this is where we get into, you know, what do those terms really mean? What do they have from it? The example of like the one I had from it is it's also, if I want to come in, so again, saying I want to make something for it, if I want to say, hey, I'm going to write a song that sounds like something Alice in Chains wrote, I can obviously do that as a human, assuming I've listened to enough Alice in Chains, you know, and I have an idea of where their music comes from, how
they
generated
it. I've done it before. I've sat down to write a song. I've been like, oh, this is a good song. And someone's like, yeah, that's just Rooster. I'm like, oh, dang, it is. You know, I just accidentally rediscovered it. It happened the other day. I was writing a little ballad, and I'm like, oh, this sounds familiar. And someone goes, that sounds like Silent Lucidity by Queensryche. It's like, oh, crap, it is.
Yeah, and I think that's the, you know, that you bump into those kind of things. So, you know, generally behind it. But you also could do something where I say, you know, imitate something. So if I actually said imitate, you know, Alice in Chains, we have people who do that. We have Elvis impersonators, you know, obviously.
Yeah, you have tribute
out
bands,
there.
Yeah.
Hey, you have tribute bands out there. They are imitating what these things are. And that's, I don't think most people say that is a copyright infringement to imitate them. Now, the production of their actual music could be an issue.
But we have compulsory licensing to cover this.
That. But, you know, but we've acknowledged there is a copyright infringement there. Yeah. But if you say the person looks like Elvis in the way they're dancing around, you get into likeness rights, not
separate
copyright.
Yeah,
that's not copyright. Issue. You know, and so when we say something like that, hey, produce something in the style of this person, Elvis impersonators do not generate original Elvis music. At least I don't know of any that do.
They're performers, right?
Yeah.
They're up there doing covers, basically.
Yeah, they're doing covers a very particular way, very particular sort of style, it's whatever it is. But they're not doing original music of what they think the person would potentially produce in the future.
They're not doing like, here's a hypothetical new Elvis. I gave you the example before we sat down of what if the Beatles, what if they were still alive and making music in the 90s? What would the sound be like? What would their albums be called? And just as a test, I asked ChatGPT to name what, give me an example of like a Beatles album in the 90s, what they might call it. And the answers weren't that interesting. It basically took, you know, phrases and words that they used in their original albums in the 60s and just substituted them into album names from the 90s.
Yeah.
Like Never Mind the Universe and stuff
and
like that.
I think
that.
The real thing behind that, and I think the important thing behind it, when we talked about what those categories were about derivative work, we sound like we're falling into those categories, don't we? Like, you know, that's what it is. When we say if we did it with a human that said, hey, what is it going to be? You're not going to be recasting, you know, or, you know, I'm not going to take and record, you know, Let It Be in the style of if it was being played by XYZ guitarist from the 90s.
Yeah.
You know, I'm going to write something entirely new based on the way kind of I would have thought the Beatles would evolve based on music evolving.
What's a good example of this is a Weird Al. His polka adaptations are recasting, transforming, and adapting. Like, the original is recognizable. It is a version of the original in
some sense. Which is why they're hilarious.
This is why they're awesome. With his own lyrics. So that's a good example of like a traditional derivative work that is a wholly original work, but it's definitely a recasting or transformation of a pre-existing work in a way that, okay, I've listened to the entire Rolling Stones catalog, and now I'm going to write a new quote unquote Rolling Stones song that's completely original, but it is, again, it's just in their style. That would be permitted.
Yeah. I mean, that would be permitted, you know, behind it. I think the real problem you bump into in conjunction with AI is in some sense, is it writing a new Rolling Stones song, or is it just taking lots of parts of Rolling Stones songs and putting them together in a different order? And what's the difference between those two?
And I think it goes back to, we know with the human that it's just the way art is made, but we don't know with the AI exactly what's going on under the hood.
Because we have a black box problem.
Yeah, because it's a black box problem. So since we don't know, we're kind of just assuming the worst. And I think part of the motivation with the I think part of the concern here is not just we don't get how it works and we're worried about that, but the practical implications for the industry and for the future of artistic endeavor. And I think, you know, the way the law is right now, we've struck a balance that if it holds might get us past this, which is, I think there's a decent chance that the courts wind up saying the mere act of using the training data by itself is a fair use. I think there's a fair shot of that happening.
Yep.
And if that happens, then create all the AI as you want. That part, just stopping right there. I built the AI, a fair use. You aren't hurting anybody yet. Once you start producing outputs, now maybe you've got a harm because you have a market substitute for the originals. People can get the stuff they want without hiring the artists. The problem we have there is, how do you identify who your plaintiff is? Is it everybody whose stuff was copied? How would you know if it was you or not? And how would you know to what degree any particular output was based on your specific contribution? So then we get into, is the answer to this the same thing with the mechanical licensing? Just make it a compulsory licensing system where if you're using an AI engine, then everybody gets 12 cents.
Well, I think the problem, and I think part of the problem you get into with it as well is the practical side, the opposite side of that, is if we say it's a fair use, do I now not have incentive to not put my stuff out there or to put it out with something? I think there's a product, but it's called Nightshade right now that poisons AIs. Yeah. You know, they try to grab the thing. Do we really want that to be the way stuff gets put out? Do we want it to be that, hey, every image that gets put on the internet has a watermark on it, you know, that obscures it because we're worried about an AI doing it in this way. We can basically stop it from being able to do what it's doing. Is that really a good solution? And I think a lot of people would say, no, that's not a good solution. So maybe we should say it's not fair use and basically say, look, you know, let's put a compulsory license in, but let's put the compulsory license in on the front end. If I want to use your data to train my AI, I have to pay you at least this.
It's sort of an opt-in system. Like the default is not just I get to use whatever, but you can opt into getting compensation by having your stuff using training data if you're fine with it. Then the other thing on the flip side is, right now, the outputs are, for the most part, as far as we know, not going to be copyrightable. Maybe that's the price you pay as the consumer of this stuff. You're going to not have to pay an artist to produce these things, but you're getting only whatever an AI can generate, which, despite some of the crazy things we see online, the vast majority of the graphical output I've seen is not that impressive. I know some of it is high quality, but a lot of work goes into that, almost as much work as it would take just to do it the right way. So if we say there's no copyright in that, so yeah, you can write a comic book using AI outputs, but then anybody else can come take all your images and use them.
But then I think what you then bump into is the next thing is, if there's no compulsory licensing on the front end, can I not use just all the back ends of the AI, which aren't protected by AI, as my training data? So sort of do I backdoor into the original data using the output data, which is now not copyright protected? And does that create a further
sort
problem?
Sort of IP laundering almost.
Yeah, IP laundering is a good way to put it. In some sense, what we're looking at here is the same thing sort of. I mean, I was a big thing for me in the Warhol episode. We talked about that. We have a problem that whichever way we say copyright falls in this, we potentially create a further parade of problems.
Yeah.
And do we need to just figure out which of those we want at this stage and go forward with it? Which was kind of my take in the Warhol case, which was, hey, if we say he's an infringer, yes, it's going to cut off creativity doing what he's doing, but it also means that he gets to protect what he has from other people doing it to him.
Yeah.
And so isn't that sort of the better solution than the opposite, which says he's not an infringer, but then me as John Doe can do the same thing to his works?
Yeah, because we had this question afterwards after the Warhol case. Now that we found out that it's not a fair use, does that mean that he does not actually, the Warhol estate does not own a copyright in those prints images? And it's kind of tough, right? Because the fair use analysis is not just the degree of transformation, but how it's used.
Yeah.
So, we looked into the law on this, and it's not at all clear. It's possible that he still does, and it's possible he doesn't. But that's sort of another unanswered question that lingers from that case.
And I think that's it. And you know, maybe this is sort of a good place to sort of come to a conclusion in this is one of the things I think we're really struggling with the AI, where the law is really struggling here, is we're dealing with this scenario where we know what the law is trying to do, but we don't know how to get there from where we currently are.
Well, I think, kind of going back to a point we were discussing earlier, I think in part the answer is going to be, what is it that we think is valuable about art?
Yeah.
What is the humanity aspect of that we're trying to preserve and protect? And the legal institutions we put in place will probably ultimately reflect what that judgment is. And that changes over time. So I'm kind of glad that for the moment the government is staying its hand and kind of letting this play out and see, is this something that courts can solve and get right somehow? Or is this something that markets can introduce products that will help us fix some of these problems and find new ways to make money? They did this with the last big disruptive thing, which was Napster and the online music sharing. You know, the industry really wanted Congress to jump in and regulate their business model into law. And Congress was like, let's wait and see what happens. And, you know, the industry is still, you know, not where it was 20 years ago, but I think probably in hindsight, that was the right call to not be too aggressive on that. So we'll see what happens here. But I think at the end of the day, it's going to reflect on some level what it is we decide makes art valuable and what it is we want to encourage people to do and not do.
In some sense, we can look at it and say ChatGPT is not writing the laws. They're still being written by humans. And so to the extent they're being written by humans, they're reflecting human values. based upon what we think AI fits in a human value system. Even if, and that kind of same thing is, it's what is art in a human value system is going to be indicated by what is the law around art generated by a human value system.
There you go.
And we'll see where that, you know, potentially goes. But yeah, it's, this is far from settled. This is going to be stuff which is, we're going to be
probably
talking about
will not
this
be our last episode about this.
Yeah, well, certainly not. But I think it's a good start and a good place to start thinking about it.
All right. So up next, we're going to try and go alternating between sort of the substantive legal episodes like this and the fluff episodes. As I've got this in my head, the last episode we put out will be our Last of Us episode. This one will be this one. The next one will be our Vision Season 2 review episode. And then we don't know what's going to happen next, but we have a lot of good ideas and we can't wait to bring that content to you. So stay tuned. Hopefully we are better this year by getting stuff to you, and we look forward to talking at you the next time. Warren, play us out.
The views expressed by the participants of this program are their own and do not represent the views of, nor are they endorsed by, Lewis Rice LLC, its officers, directors, employees, agents, representatives, shareholders, and subsidiaries. None of the content should be considered legal advice. As always, consult a lawyer. This podcast was produced and recorded in St. Louis, Missouri.